This is one of the things that the 43 group is known by and should be known in the future, that you do not wait to be attacked. You take the fight of the enemy and attack those before they attack you.
We do find ourselves in a very tricky situation, sometimes outnumbered. Anything you do to deter people from nasty things they want to do was a good thing.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Radio 43. This is the Anti-Fascism Podcast from Hope Not Hate. And if this is your first time here, this is the show when we go over some things that the far right have been up to and look ahead at some future issues that are coming down the line. This is a slightly different show, similar to the previous two episodes that we've done on the podcast. We're going to be doing a deep dive on one issue, and this is a bit of a follow-up to what we spoke about last week with Joe and Rosie to do with anti-migrant activism, but we're going to be coming at it from a slightly different angle. And on the show this week, I'm delighted to be joined by two new faces on the Radio 43 podcast, Misbah Malik and Anki Deo. Welcome to the show, both of you. How are you doing?
All good. Excited to be here.
It's great to have you on. You're two new faces on the podcast, but you're also fairly new members of the team, aren't you? So do you want to tell us a little bit about yourselves and what you do at Hope Not Hate?
I'm Misbah. I'm the Senior Policy and Engagement Officer. Both me and Anki have been here for kind of coming up to 6 months now. So I kind of work with Rosie, who was on the last episode, mostly doing our policy stuff and also like wider sector engagement. Predominantly for my first 6 months, this has focused on migration because that's kind of been one of our key issues. I cover kind of other stuff as well. It's the migration stuff that I've been focused on mostly.
Yeah, and I'm Anki. I'm the Community Response Coordinator. So my role is to work, rather than with the organised far right, with the communities who are susceptible to them. So it's mostly kind of going into communities where they've either raised concerns or there is like a lot of anti-migrant activity, and helping them work out what kind of solutions we can put in place to tackle either like active demonstrations and things like that, or also just low community resilience where there's a sense that the community is kind of at quite a high tension point. Like Misbah said, we've been focusing a lot on migration, but it could be any far right issue really.
Well, it's great to have you both on. You've both been doing a fantastic job in your short time here. So it's, I'm really looking forward to getting into this with you. But before we get going, if you'd like to find out a bit more about the work of Hope Not Hate, please do head to our website. We publish new blogs, pieces of research most weeks, and you can discover a bunch of ways in which you can help the fight against the far right. So do go there and check it out when you get a moment. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, this is a bit of a follow-up to last week's episode on anti-migrant demonstrations. And for a while now, we've been seeing a situation in which the far right has been targeting small towns around the country that have had spaces used in them for temporary accommodation. And they've been stirring up local tensions around anti-migrant accommodation, And it has been, the far right's been exploiting that tension to try and build a bit of a movement around the country. And it's a bleak situation. It's a desperate one for people stuck in this temporary accommodation. And yesterday, the first asylum seekers arrived at the Bibby Stockholm barge in Portland. It's just down on the Dorset coast. And have you got a sense of what's been going on down there before we get into sort of a bit more details on what's been going on the last 6 months? This is obviously a new development. The Fire Brigades Union described this place as a potential death trap. I think it was meant to house 200 people. It's now plans to hold over 500 people, I think, on it. It's a really shocking, inhumane, disgraceful situation. What's your read on this?
Yeah, so I guess, as you said, the first asylum seekers arrived on Monday. There were 15 that arrived. Initially, there were meant to be 35 in total, but 20 of the transfers got kind of cancelled last minute because it came out that the government's risk assessment of these asylum seekers had found kind of that a lot of them were victims of torture, had kind of mental health issues, some of them were disabled. And so their transfers were cancelled last minute, which I think is just like really indicative of the approach that the government is taking towards the safety of asylum seekers, in the sense that they really just don't care about them. They're not prioritizing safeguarding. And whilst like this is a really shocking turn of events, and kind of the level of inhumanity of like government solutions to housing asylum seekers has been getting increasingly worrying and increasingly unsuitable. It's not really a shocking development in the sense that we've seen the government relying on these like increasingly inhumane solutions to the asylum backlog over the past couple of years. And I guess like as Rosie would have said in our last episode, our assessment of the situation is that whilst the ultimate solution is that the government needs to kind of resort to appropriate community-based accommodation for asylum seekers, in the interim where those solutions aren't available, they need to be putting in appropriate safeguarding measures for asylum seekers. And to be able to do that on a literal marine barge where your capacity is two times what it should be, it's just completely impossible.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's a brilliant summation of the situation. I just wanted to just touch on that because I know this is meant to be a bit more of a positive podcast than the last week, but it's obviously big in the news. It's been a big development. I think there's some indication that some anonymous far-right activists have been targeting staff on board, calling them collaborators and that kind of thing as well. So it's, again, indicative of a kind of broader, febrile, hostile atmosphere in some of these towns. But as I said, the reason I've got you on today is to talk about how communities have been responding to this situation and how they've been standing up to the far right. But could you give us a sense of what's some of the impact that this situation has been having on these towns around the country?
I think one of the most complicated things about the situation is that it's a lot of people agree, and in fact we do too, that the accommodation plans for asylum seekers aren't appropriate. Yeah. But it's all about getting people to understand how to oppose them for the right reasons. And people's gut instinct is to oppose them. And then if you've got far-right agitators saying, you know, it's because the criminal activity is going to go up, it's because these people are illegal migrants who are scrounging, you know, that they're trying to kind of spread this, these kind of poisonous narratives that suit them, a lot of people are ending up going along with it and feeling that those are the people who are listening to them in the community. And actually, the real line is kind of what Misbah was alluding to, which is it's not safe, it's not the right solution for anyone. I mean, for example, a community like Portland in Dorset is so small. The idea that you would add 500 people to any small community, no matter what it was, is, you know, quite like a shocking development for a community. So you can see why people are quite surprised and also trying to react. There's also like the wider political context of the cost of living crisis and all of those things. So it's quite a tricky balance to understand people's concerns and where they're coming from, where they're legitimate, but then really drawing a very clear boundary between these are things that it's okay to be worried about and we understand that and none of us want to be in this situation, versus your concerns are now crossing over into like racism, making massive generalizations about asylum seekers and believing myths about asylum seekers that are mostly perpetrated within far-right rhetoric. I think a great example of that is the situation that's happening in Clonakilty, because a lot of local people are concerned about the fact that I think it was around 100 people lost their job. Now, that's completely reasonable.
That was in the hotel, right?
Yeah, it was all the staff of the hotel, because that was a very popular wedding venue and, you know, people would have their big parties and stuff there, as well as using it as a hotel. And that's completely understandable. But what's quite sad to see is that that initial concern that was really based around community has just gotten really poisonous really quickly. And that's because the far right have been in there kind of twisting the knife.
So you're getting contacted by groups and activists all the time. And what are the, you know, in terms of people trying to figure out how to better respond to these situations locally, what are the kinds of requests that you're getting from local groups?
There's a few different things that people get in touch with us about. And it's worth mentioning as well that often when we think about the issue of anti-migrant activism, we think about the big demonstrations, because those are the things that make the news. But actually, some of the most helpful kind of contact that we make is before it gets to that point, because sometimes by the time it's there and you can't get a kind of group together or you can't get a response together, some of the situation has kind of the cat's out of the bag. But for example, people get in touch with us saying that they've received a leaflet through their door. And if they can tell us exactly where that is, that's helpful for us to track. Also, people sometimes get in touch to let us know about conversations that are happening on social media. That's another really important one, because particularly community Facebook groups, which are set up, you know, community watch or neighborhood watch kind of stuff. Again, it starts off being, I'm just concerned about my kid's safety. And then it ends up being, you know, assumptions about asylum seekers and what their role in the community will, how that will impact safety. So I think when people contact about us about those, that's quite helpful because we can kind of get in early. But also a lot of the time, people are worried about upcoming demos. And normally, in terms of like how we get back in touch with them, there's a mixture of just sharing information and then actually planning things. So when it comes to information sharing, we have obviously our amazing research team. They'll have their read on things. Like as a policy team, we'll also have a bit of an idea of like what the community situation is. And we'll be able to just pass on information about, you know, this person is a member of the organized far right, or we can't see much about this person, but we're looking into them because we are also worried about what they're posting online or what they're saying. And then in terms of organizing things, it can be anything really, like different areas need different solutions. But often people want to organize like counter demonstrations or events that show that as well as there being an anti-migrant contingent in the local area, they want to show that there's people who resist that. And then we also would help with kind of the press and like media stuff around making sure that that side of the argument gets just as much attention, because sometimes that anti-migrant side can be the story and can be quite vocal.
Sorry, I've muted myself. That's definitely a really important element to it, for sure. So people get in touch with us, but also we're reaching out to groups as well and activists. And Misbah, I know you're speaking quite regularly to the councillor network that we have. And how responsive are councillors tend to be on this subject? I mean, is there a lot of anxiety locally?
Yeah, so I think when it comes to our engagement with councillors, it's kind of a two-pronged approach. So the first is kind of what you've mentioned, and it's kind of related to their involvement in communities. Councillors are very plugged in, having lots of conversations with kind of the people they represent. So we've seen, I think that's kind of where we've seen most engagement with the councillor network. Anki has been creating lots of resources about kind of how to speak about the issue of asylum accommodation. And like, I've been translating these into kind of counselor friendly resources, which basically just give explainers about the far right, how they can talk to people in their communities about their concerns, kind of validating, as Anki was saying, the very legitimate concerns they're having, but then also kind of putting your foot down when it kind of goes into far right territory. So we've seen a lot of engagement and a lot of response when we've been putting those sorts of helpful resources out. And I think the second way that we're engaging with the councillor network is on more of like a political level. Obviously, councillors can have political buy-in. They often represent a party. So an example of this is after we did our most recent report on anti-migrant rhetoric used by the government and the media. It's called Stoking the Flames. You can find it on our website. We basically helped draft a letter from our councillor network that went to the Home Office, which was basically saying, detailing all the different ways that this inflammatory rhetoric is impacting community cohesion, community resilience, increasing tensions in the community that can then take years to rebuild once they spill over, which is something that we're seeing happening. And that was signed by lots of people in our councillor network and was then sent to the Home Office. We're still waiting for a reply. But yeah, so there's also been a lot of engagement in the more kind of political sense that can have, I guess, more of an impact on a kind of wider national level. So yeah, there is definitely a lot of interest from councillors and from kind of all local community groups as well.
That's great.
The only thing I would add to that though, just if I can, is I think sometimes there's a bit of a concern around how political the issue is, and that can be a bit tricky to like weave our way around, because especially when it's councillors, but obviously we're looking towards a general election, migration might be a voting issue, thinking about kind of how like I think people are a lot more wary of how not to alienate their audience. And for us, again, it's about making really clear the line between what's kind of legitimate political opinion, and, you know, people have the right to have opinions that are across the spectrum, and then what goes beyond that into, you know, fear mongering and like spreading tension through a community in a really unhelpful way. And so often, if people are a bit more tentative and a bit more nervous about getting involved with us, it's about making them see the line's been crossed here. So we kind of have to do something.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there's a difficult dynamic in the sense of, you know, there is some local politicking going on, you know, council's not necessarily, I mean, this is me speaking, this isn't you speaking, but I think, you know, quite around the country, there's, you know, local elected who don't necessarily feel confident speaking out about the issue for political reasons. And I think there's a moral case which needs to be taken. And like I say, that's me speaking, that's, you know, that's not, I'm not putting words in your mouth there, but I think it's a difficult job to get some of these characters to speak out in a kind of moral way. But I think let's move on to some of the more positive stuff, because there's been some really, really great stuff that's been going on in terms of responding to the anti-migrant movement. And I'd love to dig into a few of these in a bit of detail. I think one of the things I really want to try and touch on is how our supporters who are listening, if there's a comparable situation happening in their areas, how they can, I guess, take some inspiration from what's been going on around the country. And I think one of the really important things to remember is that, you know, parachuting activists into an area isn't really conducive to kind of getting good outcomes. And so, you know, we need to be working on the ground with people. And that's what I think is really exciting and interesting about the work that that you both have been doing, is that there's been so much engagement on the ground, working collaboratively as a core element of the strategy. And I think the results kind of speak for themselves. So I'd love to get into a bit of that with you both. So you've mentioned, I'm going to apologize to all of our Welsh listeners, but you've mentioned Llanelli. Is that good? I don't know. Already. But can we go a little bit into a bit more detail about what happened there? Because that's still ongoing, I believe, isn't it, the situation?
Yeah, very much ongoing. So we got in touch right at the beginning, because actually one of our supporters contacted us to say, you know, this is happening, not sure what's going on. And he's worked with asylum seekers before, when Syrian asylum seekers came to the town. So it was kind of relatively in the know about it, and was managing to get some community meetings together of people who did a mixture of support services for asylum seekers, so things like English lessons, food and clothing donations, and then people who would be interested in doing something to make sure that there was like the appropriate welcome. And what's been really interesting is exactly what you were saying about the local context and our response being really locally driven, because there have actually been a few times where we've suggested stuff and the response we've got is, you know, it's not exactly the right time, or that's not really where local people are at. A massive learning for me, which is probably going to sound a bit ignorant, is Llanelli has a massive Welsh speaking population. So anything that we do needs to be translated into both languages. There's those two different demographics to reach. And so I think that's what's been really amazing about working with local people who know their area and kind of are able to feed those insights in, because the kind of one size fits all approach will never work as well as when you've got someone with that local expertise, which is why it's so great when people get in touch with us and they're keen to do things. So to kind of put it in context of the anti-migrant situation, a camp started outside the hotel where it was pretty formal. There was like gazebos and portaloos and food and stuff, and local people were doing shifts camping outside there before any asylum seekers had even arrived. Then the arrival date for asylum seekers got delayed. I think partially because they weren't able to make deliveries, but there were a number of reasons. And then there was also a kind of court case happening in the background. And so alongside all of this, this Llanelli Hope Not Hate group formed, where their aim was basically to show that there was a different side of the town. The camp and anti-migrant side of things had almost like cornered the market in community spirit, and they were very much all over Facebook and like social media saying we've got the best community, we're really showing that we care about fellow people, but they weren't showing any concern for the asylum seekers and the traumatic circumstances they've been through. So that was why there was a Clonakilty Hope Not Hate Facebook page set up, which gave some information about migration in kind of more broader terms and also information about the situation in Clonakilty. And then they planned a couple of amazing events. So one was a picnic that took place in the local park. I think it's called Park Howard. And they invited lots of people along to share Welsh cakes and kind of eat together. There were banners that had very kind of generic but positive messages that everyone could get behind, and their point is essentially it doesn't have to be pro-migration, it just has to be pro-humanity, and there's space for, you know, debate, there's space for disagreement, but kindness is the absolute minimum that we need. And I think that was quite a helpful message, because there are a few people that we can see even like online from some of our snooping who are concerned about the hotel, concerned about the jobs, those kinds of things, but then starting to get a bit freaked out by some of the more extreme stuff that's getting said online. And those people could still find a place in the Clonakilty Hope Not Hate group, because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't only saying we accept asylum seekers. They were saying we also accept people who might be slightly unsure, and we want to have a conversation with you and like chat to you about that. But it wasn't kind of, oh, you've gone extreme that end, we're going to go extreme the other end. And it sounds a bit cynical to say, but actually sometimes the best thing is preventing a really terrible situation rather than, you know, getting everyone to agree with you is probably the next step. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not always as straightforward as that, is it? There's definitely stepping stones along that pathway. It sounds like they're doing a good job up there. And is it... similar situation in Cumbria, but it's not quite as febrile in Cumbria, is it?
No, Cumbria's kind of settled down in many ways, because the flashpoint was around a court case. Okay. So this all happened in, I think, March, April time. There was a man who had been charged with rape, and it was kind of pegged as this whole representative story of this is what happens when they're in our community. Of course, we know that gender-based violence takes place in communities like regardless of ethnicity or race or any of those things, but it was kind of seen as almost like a scapegoating issue. And we were working with an amazing organization called Anti-Racist Cumbria, who wanted to go beyond just a counter protest to have like a visible presence at the court, but also actually start a dialogue and try and understand what was going on with the side who were opposed to it and what their thinking was. And so that's actually quite an ongoing situation. I'm speaking to them on Thursday, and they've started getting together a plan to have a mediated conversation where they're not just giving up on the other side, they're trying to understand what it is that they're worried about. And I think particularly when the concerns are around something as real and as important as gender-based violence and violence against women, there is a real need to take that seriously. But again, like I said, I'm sounding like a broken record now, distinguishing and like drawing that clear line between it's okay to be worried about violence, it's not okay to assume that one group is going to be the perpetrators of that violence. So I'm really excited to see what the outcomes are there, because that's quite a new approach for them to wanting to be like talking to the other side, so to speak. So that should hopefully be really exciting, and hoping for a positive outcome there, because that's quite a big move from them, I think.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what comes out of that. The other example I wanted to touch on very briefly is Llantwit Major, which is another place in Wales, isn't it? And I think this is a slightly different dynamic, because this had real proper organised far-right involvement. Yes. In the kind of demonstration. This was Patriotic Alternative who were very busy over there. They've been flyering and all kinds of things. What's the situation over there now, and how did Hope Not Hate help with the kind of response over there?
The situation there now is much better. So Patriotic Alternative came once, were basically shooed away, said they were going to come another time and ended up not coming. Both times, this group called Clonakilty 24 Together in Kindness had organised these various fun events. It was almost like more like a village fair, the atmosphere that they had there, because they didn't want it to be too serious. There was also a Stand Up to Racism demonstration, but their aim was quite similar to the Llanelli one, in that they wanted to attract a broader political spectrum of people and not just the kind of traditional left who might come to these things, because the demographics in Clanswick Major are quite mixed. And so they decided that this message of kindness would bring that whole group of people together. And that group, Clanswick 24, are still kind of talking to each other, still organizing. They meet with each other regularly, and they're kind of trying to move away from just reactive stuff to actually being a positive force in the community, because they did manage to get this amazing group of people together, all different ages. There were lots of kids and families, all different faiths. They had interfaith celebrations. So that was a really positive one. And we actually had a really good webinar that we held with the organizers of that, which we've written up. So if anyone's interested in kind of how it went from start to finish, because what was really interesting is Rich and Liv talked a lot about how they didn't know each other before the whole patriotic alternative situation happened. And now it's turned into this like active group. It's quite an inspiring story of like people who just wanted to do something and actually made it happen.
The far right came to divide a town, and what they did was actually bring people together in opposition. Yeah, it's an inspiring story. In terms of Ms. Brown, like a policy level then, how do these kind of stories from, you know, Llanwit and Llanelli and Cumbria, how do they sort of feed back into what's going on in the policy team? And do they shape your responses elsewhere? And do they shape other pieces of work that you're working on? Or
Yeah, definitely. I think it's quite interesting, because a lot of the time in the policy world, when you're trying to do political influencing, particularly in the refugee sector, which is, you know, just abhorrently grim at the moment, a lot of the time when you're influencing, you're trying to draw attention to how bad the situation is, and it's very doom and gloom. It's, you know, awful statistics, awful stories. But I think what's been great about having these kind of case studies and having examples of where things go well, it's basically showing the other side of what could happen if we had the right things in place. So for example, I guess actually it comes in two parts, because we do national influencing and local influencing. So our local influencing, a lot of the time that's with local councils, local authorities. And what we can do with these case studies is present them as examples of good practice, which has been really, really great. We're in regular contact with the LGA, the local government kind of coalition group that meet regularly, and we can kind of give them best practice examples of how to address situations. Obviously, as Anki said, there's no one size fits all, but it is quite good to help inspire, I guess, other locations of how they can kind of respond positively to these incidents. And then on a national level, I think where this kind of fits into our political influencing is when we're making a case for resources and money to go towards resilience and community cohesion. A lot of the time, and Anki will be able to kind of speak more to this, but a lot of the time when people are getting in contact, and especially when we're speaking to like local authorities and local councils as well, the biggest concern is, you know, we want to do all these things that are going to bring the community together. We want to invest in community resilience, but we just don't have the resources for it. And so one of like the policy calls that we're taking to kind of the national level and to the government is to show the need for investment and the prioritization of community resilience. Because we know that when a community is resilient, it's kind of works as a preventative measure for the far right to be able to infiltrate. So it's hugely important, not just kind of in responding to events when the far right come to local towns, but also from preventing that from happening in the first place. So by using these case studies within our kind of briefings to politicians or to MPs, it really, really helps. A big part of influencing is obviously convincing people that there's a need for things. And being able to use these positive stories as an example of kind of how the changes that we're calling for would be able to make a difference has been really, really useful.
I think that, I mean, that was fascinating, because I think it just really shows the sort of holistic approach that you're taking in the policy team to this issue. Like, there's so many different levels you're working on. And as I said at the top of the show, you know, I think you're both doing a brilliant job. So, you know, thank you for all the work you're doing. Just, I want to touch on a couple of just final points, if I may, before we go, which is, I think as we've both, you know, as all of us have said on this call, the hotels, there are, you know, it's a terrible strategy from the government. It's an inhumane strategy. I would say that personally, I believe that that is part of the intention for it to be awful and divisive, and as part of a broader election strategy moving into next year. But obviously the far right, what the far right is up to is appalling, is horrific, and is inflaming the situation and making it, you know, much worse. What more do you think the anti-fascist movement and the left in general could be doing on this issue? Because I think, as you mentioned at the top of the show, Anki, you were saying that we all think that the hotels are a terrible strategy, and it's difficult. You don't want to sound like you're arguing in favor of them over something else. So what more could the movement be doing, do you think?
I think there's a few different things. Maybe we can touch on the more like political level, but on the community level, I think either it's going to support if there's something locally, you know, whether that's a counter protest, whether that's a community event, and actually just showing up. Often the optics of these situations are really important, and the far right really, really care about how many people were there. If they're outnumbered, that hurts them. That's always good for us. But also,
they also wildly inflate their numbers. It's worth
it. It is quite funny. Yeah, like 10 people can become 47 quickly. I think the other thing that's kind of more softer is having these conversations about, you know, maybe getting people you know and care about to explain why they feel certain things, especially when it comes to things like the assumptions around criminality or the assumptions around like economic migration versus seeking asylum. A lot of the time these conversations are happening in a gentle way online, and before they get to that fever pitch, it's about, you know, actually engaging with them. I think sometimes people can feel quite like, I know what I think and it's too much to talk about, but actually on the local level, it's local people with influence who can have the biggest impact. Someone like me coming in, like I can do the kind of emergency recovery stuff, but actually it's people who you know and trust and respect who you're going to listen to the most. So I think wherever people feel they have influence, using that to say the right things is really important.
Yeah, and I think on a political level, my kind of, I guess, call to action would be to support the refugee sector. Like Hope Not Hate's, I guess, stake in this conversation is purely from the far right aspect and when the far right are involved. But as we've kind of spoken about, it's a much wider issue to do with, you know, asylum backlog, safe and legal routes, all of that kind of feeds into this. So my suggestion would be, you know, get involved with a local refugee charity or kind of the more national ones, and support their political asks, because, you know, they're the experts in this kind of particular issue, and can speak to the specific asks much better than we can.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on, Anki and Misbah. I really, really appreciate your time. I think you've had some really fascinating insights. So thank you very much. And thanks to everybody for listening as well.
If people want to get in touch with us, they definitely should.
Yeah.
That's always super helpful. And it's great to be connected with our supporters.
Definitely. Thanks so much. Speak soon.
You cannot prevent 50 people, 50 postmen or 50 dustmen from having anti-Semitic thoughts. But you can prevent 50 dustmen forming an anti-Semitic dustmen association. You take the fight of the enemy and attack those before they attack you.